This is Viewpoint with attorney and author Chuck Crismeyer. Viewpoint is a one-hour talk show confronting the issues of America's heart and home. And now with today's edition of Viewpoint, here is Chuck Crismeyer.
Lyme disease is on the rise, friends, and it's not spelled L-I-M-E, it's L-Y-M-E. I happen to enjoy Lyme-Aide in the summertime, but I don't enjoy Lyme disease. May marks the beginning of the summer season when black-leg ticks that spread Lyme disease are more prevalent. It's spreading all across the country now. The U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention has reported that cases of tick-borne disease have more than doubled, that Lyme disease accounts for about 82% of tick-borne diseases, and due to the underreporting, the actual number of Lyme disease cases is estimated to be, well, in the range of 450,000. Now, that's a lot, but it doesn't seem like a lot compared to millions. But if you get Lyme disease or somebody in your family or in your neighborhood, somebody that you know gets Lyme disease, it ain't funny. There are several potential reasons why rates have increased. One is globalization. People traveling extensively could get Lyme disease, get tick bites on the East Coast and make their way to the West Coast, and then it spreads. Another reason is climate change, because there's been some warming going on around the world, and that actually creates a warmer environment for the ticks to come out and do their nasties. Lyme disease is therefore not, though, considered to be contagious, at least not with humans. It's just not contagious. And so today on Viewpoint, we're going to be dealing with this subject of Lyme disease. We're going to be talking about the Lyme connection that began back in 1975. If you ever traveled up and down the East Coast, you know that there's a place called Old Lyme, Connecticut. Old Lyme, Connecticut. And I've been there. It's a beautiful place up there. But it gained a name, a notorious name, because of a disease called Lyme disease. Let's talk about it here on Viewpoint today. We have a special guest joining us, Catherine Camp, who has had her own horrific experience with Lyme disease that just about consumed the life of one of her daughters. And we have been kind of part of their family experience with regard to this, and it certainly has had a tremendous impact on our lives. I also remember a dear friend, Walt Barbie, who used to be the director, the head of the Family Foundation in Richmond, Virginia, and also throughout the Commonwealth of Virginia. He contracted Lyme disease in his 60s, and it killed him. That's right, it killed him. And so Lyme disease is not just some little tick thing. It's not related to the social engine called TikTok, but it's very, very dangerous. The deer tick waits patiently for anything warm-blooded to brush by, feeding on deer as well as smaller creatures like birds and mice. The tick jumps aboard and pierces its sharp mouth hooks into the skin of its unlucky host. A tiny glutton with a king-size appetite, the tick sucks the blood of its host in a feast that can last up to 2 whole days while it swells to a bubble over 3 times its original size. At the same time, the little parasite deposits its own fluids into the host, fluids that sometimes prove fatal. The feeding habitats of ticks and the swimming abilities of deer were little concern to the residents of Old Lyme, Connecticut in July of 1975. That quaint New England town, for the most part an upper crust community, America's oldest towns founded by the English Puritans, Old Lyme was enjoying its tricentennial as the nation prepared for a bicentennial. But a strange set of occurrences that year would forever change its reputation from a warm, charming enclave to a place of fear and despair. Why? Well, nestled on the banks of the Connecticut River, Old Lyme sits just a shade north of the Long Island Sound. As little ones frolicked in the sun, ignoring the blistering heat, Polly Murray and Judith Mintz noticed something unusual about their children. Seemingly out of nowhere, they were showing signs of strange physical and mental ailments. So alarmed, the two mothers quickly phoned their neighbors who were observing strikingly similar conditions in their own kids. Many of the kids in the neighborhood and some adults were suffering from the same skin rashes, throbbing headaches, and painful swollen joints. So Polly and Judith brought their concerns to the Connecticut Department of Health, which immediately appointed physicians from Yale University to investigate. The doctors misdiagnosed 39 children and 12 adults with juvenile rheumatoid arthritis, a condition they named Lyme arthritis. But 2 years later, scientists linked Lyme arthritis to the bite of a deer tick. And in 1981, Dr. Wally Burgdorfer, a researcher at the National Institutes of Health, discovered a thin spiral bacteria, in technical terms a spirochete, immersed in the fluid of a deer tick. And he proved that the new spirochete was to blame not for Lyme arthritis, but for an entirely new ailment called Lyme disease. Borrelia burgdorferi, named in honor of its discoverer, attacks humans in a number of ways, which is one reason why it remains so difficult to diagnose. It attacks the body's nervous, central nervous system, and it's dangerous. And that's why we're talking about it here on Viewpoint, confronting the deepest issues of America's heart and home. Joining us, Catherine Camp, in the Commonwealth of Virginia, just outside of Richmond, Virginia. Joining us, a dear Christian sister. I've joined her on her podcast a number of different times. And here she is joining us to talk about this very, very serious issue called Lyme disease. And we've just escaped the earliest month in which it occurs, which is May. And here we are. June is busting out all over. And Catherine, what would be your preliminary statement to those who are listening today?
Well, first of all, Chuck, thanks for inviting me on your show. This is a serious, serious deal. It is scary. But what I would say is, be careful. We just entered June, and we are pulling live ticks off of our dogs every single day.
Every day, and you've got plenty of dogs out there in the countryside. And if you can pull the ticks off your dogs, they can pull them off of you too, right?
Well, yes, and I'd like to present that. During our quest to help our daughter get better, I had many, many conversations with all sorts of doctors from every field. And one of them was a psychologist who understood Lyme because she had it herself.
And all right. Now, you mentioned your daughter. That's the first time this has come up. That is the centerpiece of your experience with Lyme disease, isn't it? A daughter.
Yes. Yes, it is.
How did that come about?
Well, that's quite a story.
Well, yeah, I know it's quite a story, but we need to hear at least a brief part of the story, because as Lyme disease comes on, people don't realize it. And so we need to have some sort of entry here. So right after the break, if you'll be prepared to take just a couple of minutes and give us the short version of that, we'll be right back.
All right. Okay.
Once upon a time, children could pray and read their Bibles in school. Divorces were practically unknown, as was child abuse. In our once great America, virginity and chastity were popular virtues, and homosexuality was an abomination.
So what happened in just one generation?
Hi, I'm Chuck Chrismeyer, and I urge you to join me daily on Viewpoint, where we discuss the most challenging issues touching our hearts and homes. Could America's moral slide relate to the Fourth Commandment?
Listen to Viewpoint on this radio station or anytime at saveus.org.
Again, I welcome you back to Viewpoint. I'm Chuck Chrismeyer. Our special guest today, Catherine Camp, talking with us about this matter of Lyme disease. She has experienced this up front and personal, more personal than you would care to understand. My wife and I have witnessed the pain and anguish that their family has gone through as a result of this confrontation with Lyme disease. and it contracted one of your daughters. Now, they say, Catherine, that this happens through a tick bite. But the interesting thing is, I remember your daughter never realized that she had a tick bite.
Right. What people don't realize is when a tick bites you, it has like an anesthetic automatically in its saliva, and it numbs the skin immediately, and people don't realize they've been bitten or there's one latched onto you. And that's how it benefits from just sucking on your blood.
Mm.
And like you described earlier, it also at the same time releases their kind of like saliva into you during this exchange, and that is where a lot of microorganisms are stored in their own DNA that begin to attack our systems as humans. And you don't know, you might not know that you have it. Some people right away, they get a fever, they get the red dot that everyone talks about.
Mm-hmm. But the bullseye.
The bullseye. Not everyone gets that, and
right.
our daughter never did.
Mm.
And it manifested probably as a strep throat. And so you take your child to the doctor's office, get antibiotics, which is usually a 10-day course for most people.
Right.
And then that's it. You know, you don't have strep throat anymore, but that doesn't mean you're no longer infected with whatever microorganisms have been passed on to you.
In other words, you go to the doctor and you think that, everything's wonderful, everything's cool, everything's taken care of, no more worries. But it didn't work that way for your daughter, did it?
No. No, it didn't. For a lot of people, like your friend who passed away, what happened with her is she's outside all the time, and so you find ticks, you kill them, and then that's it.
Mm-hmm.
But what happened is with this type of microorganism, Borrelia burgdorferi, if you've taken a course of antibiotics for a strep throat, ear infection, whatever, like most kids do, then what happens, it immediately sheds its outer layer, and it becomes like a sticky substance in your cells, and it hides.
Mm.
So that the next time you take antibiotics, it misses it. You know, the antibiotics do not find it. And so it begins to get into your bones, your muscular structure, your organs.
Your lymphatic system.
Mm-hmm. Yes, everything. And that, when it's been there over time, it creates like a little colony, and they're sticky. That's what it looks like under a microscope, and it does cross the blood-brain barrier with all of the different organisms that they carry now, because they have been weaponized, and I'm sure we'll talk about that later. But what happens, because it can cross everything in your body, it had stored itself in her bone structure. So when she broke her ankle in fifth grade, that's when she started to manifest symptoms, psychological symptoms, because what happened is they were in her bones, and when it broke, they had to scatter and find another place to reside.
Wow.
And it manifested first as psychological symptoms, anxiety, not understanding why she felt weird, and you're looking at a preteen in fifth grade, and you're thinking, oh, this is just normal preteen angst. And so you just go about your life, and you just, you know, as a Christian, my conversations were, well, you know, we pray when we feel anxious. We turn to Jesus, and we look to God for strength and to help us not be so anxious.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would always try to get down to, well, is there something going on at school? Is there someone being mean to you? You go through the whole social thing. Is there something that is bothering you?
All right. So this first happened when she was in the fifth grade. And
It manifested.
So you don't know exactly when it was, but the symptoms began to manifest in a very discernible fashion when she was in the fifth grade. So what was the pattern that you began to see, that she began to experience and complain of?
Well, it started with anxiety, and then a few years went by, and suddenly, I mean, that became worse. And then she had what seemed like an appendicitis attack a few years later, I'd say about 4 or 5 years later.
Mm-hmm.
And what we didn't know at that time, the Lyme, the Borrelia burgdorferi, and the microorganisms had worked their way into her organs.
Mm.
And it was the appendix was the first to show up.
Mm-hmm.
And she had that removed, and the doctor said, "This is the weirdest appendix I've ever seen." And I do these all day long. I've done thousands of them. And that didn't mean anything to me. It was like, okay, that's weird. But she never really recovered from it. When she had friends who recovered within 2 weeks, she was still having a hard time eating. And so that really kicked off a whole string of other problems of not understanding why she couldn't eat. And then there was more anxiety built onto that. Then there was a problem forgetting, you know, just like, okay, forget about it. I don't want to eat because every time I do, it causes my stomach to hurt.
So then you become anorexic.
Yes. And you get, psychologically, you're thinking, there's something wrong with me. And mm-hmm. everyone's telling you, oh, you have an eating disorder.
Uh-huh.
Well, not only that, you're going at the same time taking her to gastroenterologists and doing nuclear medicine and watching, is everything functioning right?
All right. So all in all, while you're doing this, because it's a very long story, while you're doing this, no doctor has diagnosed the problem.
None.
And
that went on for almost a decade. And
unbelievable.
Till I got to the point where she could hardly walk anymore. And was in a wheelchair and walking with a cane.
And how old was she at that point then? Late teens?
I would say 18, 19.
Mm-hmm.
Just starting college. Didn't understand why she couldn't think straight. The anxiety was worse. The depression was setting in.
Mm-hmm.
Couldn't remember things. When she finally took herself out of college for medical purposes,
mm-hmm.
by that point, we had seen every doctor you could possibly see, neurologist, cardiologist, arthritis. And
so it was affecting her heart?
Yes.
So it had invaded every aspect of her being, her various all the zones of her body, her bones, her joints, her mind, her emotions, her lymph system. Everything had been invaded. And so you ask yourself, what can I do as a parent? What am I supposed to do in a situation like this where no medical professional, after spending hundreds of thousands of dollars, is able to even put their finger on what's going on?
Well, the problem is what they do, Chuck, is they tell you, oh, it's all in your head. And they would tell her, the psychologist would say, well, you know, she just wants attention. And so she's manifesting all these symptoms.
Wow.
So after a while, you're young, you don't understand, you start thinking, maybe they're right, but I don't understand. Why would I be depressed? Why would I be manifesting? I'm making myself sick, which makes you even like think it's even worse. It makes things multiply in your head. And anyhow, so after a while, you're seeing your child pretty much decaying before your eyes. What happened with me is a friend ended up telling me about a molecular biologist who would look at her blood under a microscope, which is when I found out doctors are no longer allowed to have microscopes in their office. They used to.
Mm.
They used to be able to look at a patient's blood right there with a patient standing there or their saliva or whatever else. Doctors are not allowed to, and that kind of came along with the government taking over with companies like LabCorp, where they could monitor and have everything in a big system, probably for Medicare. I don't know. I haven't done enough research on that, but who knows?
Well, you had to do a tremendous amount of research. In fact, you had to literally become the medical diagnoser without having any medical background to try to figure out and trace what might possibly be the cause here. So you ended up, as I recall, with a doctor up in our nation's capital, didn't you?
Yes, I did. After we found out, we went to the molecular biologist. She showed us. She said, look, there's the Burgdorferi. There's the Borrelia burgdorferi. Mm-hmm. She showed us the Babesia microorganisms. We saw tularemia. We saw brucellosis. And all this from that bite, or several, whatever bites that she had over time.
Mm-hmm.
And they were all active in her system.
Wow.
And Babesia kills people. All of those will kill you. Anyhow. Yes. So once we knew what was going on, even though she was still very ill, it gave us a lot of hope.
Mm-hmm.
It gave her hope. Like, okay, now we know what's wrong. Let's get to work. And so that's when we started doing deep dive research on the best doctors who was there. One of the best films that this woman told us to watch was a documentary called Under Our Skin. And I would highly recommend that for anybody who suspects that they might have these symptoms. It's Chris Newby and her husband produced this in 2008. And
the title of it again is what?
Under Our Skin.
Under Our Skin.
Yes.
Okay.
And there's a part one and a part two where they follow six patients. And everything on that was describing everything that our daughter was going through.
Wow.
Literally everything. The psychologist and doctor saying it's all in your head. The sensations of neurological pain everywhere. Mm-hmm. Tingly feeling, skin feeling like it's burning. Inability to eat. Inability to think.
Mm-hmm.
Some people call it brain fog.
Right.
Not being able to walk anymore. Losing all of your faculties.
This had to be absolutely mind-numbing, and it's hard to explain how a mom and a father could have responded to all of this, seeing that no doctor was able to come to any kind of assistance until finally you found somebody that was able to look at the blood and identify what the cause was.
Yes, and all along, we kind of think we could have just gone to the vet and had them look at the blood, take a drop of her blood, and they would have told us everything.
Wow.
But it took a molecular biologist off the grid because she would get in trouble if they found out. Can you believe that? She would get in trouble for telling people what's in their blood.
You know, it reminds me of what the Bible says, the life is in the blood. And, you know, if we really understood that, it would make a whole lot of difference. As I'm listening to you, Catherine, I'm seeing that Lyme disease, this tick-borne disease, is very much like sin. And it gets into your spiritual bloodstream, and you don't realize how potent, how significant it really is. And you go on business as usual, and it just increases in your system, and it finds new places to lodge, and pretty soon you're completely under the dominion and control of sin in your life. And now what do? You don't understand it, and spiritual practitioners, we call them pastors, are very reluctant to identify these kinds of things because they don't want to make the person feel bad. And so you've got a situation where you're actually giving us a picture of what sin looks like and what it does in our lives. But we're going to get back to Lyme disease in just a few moments after this break. Friends, stay tuned. Catherine Camp, our special guest today. Oh, and we have barely scratched the surface. We'll be right back.
There is so much more about Chuck Chrismeyer and Save America Ministries. on our website, saveus.org. For example, under the marriage section, God has marriage on his mind. Chuck has some great resources to strengthen your marriage. First off, a fact sheet on the state of the marital union, a fact sheet on the state of ministry, marriage, and morals. SaveUS.org. Marriage, divorce, and remarriage. What does the Bible really teach about this? Find all of this at SaveUS.org. Also, a letter to pastors, the Hosea Project, SaveUS.org, and many more resources to strengthen your marriage. It's all on Chuck's website, saveus.org. Again, you can listen to Chuck's Viewpoint broadcast live and archived. Save America Ministries website at saveus.org.
Welcome back to Viewpoint. I'm Chuck Christmeyer. Just last week, I had to pull a small little deer tick off the back of my leg. They like to hide in places where you can't really see them all that well. And I looked at that little guy, and I thought, man, I hope I don't see a bullseye come up within the next few weeks concerning that. Well, I haven't seen it, but, you know, once you see the effects and understand the effects of Lyme disease, all of a sudden you take on a whole new sense of why you need to be concerned. I have right in front of me an article called Lyme Disease is on the Rise. Dr. Charles Chu, out there in California, believe it or not, is commenting about this, and he gives us some things that perhaps we should know. He says, why is it important to accurately diagnose Lyme disease? Timely and accurate diagnosis of Lyme disease can help prevent potential complications, which can include encephalitis, a brain infection, myocarditis, heart infection, endocarditis, heart valve infection. You would never have believed that, would you? Of Lyme disease? That's right, a deer tick. The CDC recommends that patients who notice the tick and remove it within 24 hours do not need antibiotic prophylaxis with doxycycline. The tick typically needs to be on you, basically sucking your blood and attached to you for 36 to 48 hours, at least 24, before it can transmit the Lyme pathogen. So it's definitely important to find the ticks early and get them off you, right? Yep. You go hiking or camping or are otherwise potentially exposed to ticks, like working in your yard, my friends? Always do a tick check. And the ticks that are most likely to transmit the bacterium are the young nymphal ticks. They're about the size of a poppy seed. So they're extremely small. Well, that was the nature of the one that I found on the back of my leg just last week. And you really need to conduct a tick check all over your body, because you won't necessarily get bitten by the tick where the grass contracted your leg. Ticks can crawl to your armpit or groin and bite there, for instance, and anywhere from 2 to 15% among the nymphal ticks, well, they carry the Lyme disease. And early Lyme disease, the test sensitivity is only about 30 to 40% efficacious. The take-home message is that we do not have an accurate test as a doctor for early Lyme disease, and this is why the diagnosis is generally made clinically by a physician, and also why there is so much underreporting, because the doctors don't even know how to detect it. Part of the reason why laboratory testing is an essential criterion for the diagnosis of Lyme disease is that we simply, he said, don't have a test that is conclusive. Wow. That's quite an admission, isn't it, Catherine?
Yeah, considering it's been around for what?
Since 1975, for certain, out there in old Lyme, Connecticut.
Yeah, and it is. It's a tricky name that they've just named it after Lyme, Connecticut. But what it really is, it's a concoction of different bacterium and parasites that were, they literally weaponized these vector-borne insects. And the ticks, I think, were probably the best vectors, because they're harder to kill. They're more hardy.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like a spider. They can live underwater for more than eight hours.
Wow.
They can be in a state. They hibernate in the winter. They're very hard to kill.
Well, they are. I mean, you get one of those ticks and you try to grind it down with your fingernail, and it's extremely resistant. It's very hard to kill a tick.
Yeah. So they carry this. This is not natural. This is gain-of-function research. The actual science was done on these insects to create. It's biowarfare.
All right, so you're referring to a place called Plum Island, aren't you?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, I have in my hand a book called Lab 257, The Disturbing Story of the Government's Secret Plum Island Germ Laboratory. People like to say, well, this is just a bizarre conspiracy theory. Well, it's not a bizarre conspiracy theory. They just like to say that because that way they can cover a multitude of sins by calling it that. But the reality is Plum Island, an animal disease center, was a United States federal research facility dedicated to the study of foreign animal diseases of livestock. And it is a national laboratory of the Department of Homeland Security, operates as a partnership with the U.S. Department of Agriculture, located off the eastern tip of Long Island, New York, right there near Old Lyme, Connecticut, right?
Yeah, and that's where the scientists would get onto the ferry to get over to the island and get off of the ferry to go back home after their shift.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, I know that they took a lot of precautions, but when you're dealing with insects, that they can't be fully contained. Plus, there's bird life that all of these animals, get onto birds, and the birds fly back and forth. The doctor my daughter ended up seeing was one of the best specialists in the world.
Uh-huh.
And he started to call it a Lyme borealis complex because it's not just one thing. And people think it's one thing because it's called Lyme. Well, that encompasses a lot of pathogens. It could be there's over 100 things that can happen to people, pathogens in there. And there's another doctor who's a biochemist, and she says she gets really mad when they call it Lyme because it's deceiving. She calls it it's a neurological pathogen.
Mm-hmm.
So she gets very upset and says, no, this is neuroborealis or something like that.
Uh-huh.
Because it does. It attacks your neurological system. And yes, you mentioned the heart, and that doctor mentioning all the heart problems. POTS is posterior orthostatic tachycardia is one of the things that it does cause, which is, it can be debilitating. And a lot of people fall constantly because they get very dizzy. Their heart's not ready to pump enough blood to the different parts of the body when you stand up, sit down, get up. So people fall. Like our daughter was constantly passing out.
And
some people.
How frightening.
It is. She fell into my arms one time just after saying good morning, and I thought she was joking around. And she literally blacked out for just a few seconds. But some people have resorted to wearing bike helmets all the time because when they have something like this, because they never know when they're going to pass out and just fall and hit their head. So it's a serious thing. Yeah, and so these vector-borne insects, and it was ticks and chiggers and fleas and mosquitoes, they were all weaponized with gain of function and thrown out there. In fact, there was a recent, about a year ago, interview that Tucker Carlson did with Chris Newby, who did the documentary on all of this and had an interview with William Burdorfer and this CIA black ops guy, she said, talked to her. She interviewed him, and he said that one of the weirdest missions that they ever sent him on was in 1962, when he was told to drop from the air a bunch of poisoned sticks over Cuba, the sugarcane field, so that they would get on the workers and create devastation and death without anyone ever even suspecting anything.
Wow.
So this is serious, and I think this is what has happened with alpha-gal, which is another tick-borne illness that's showing up around here. Especially, it's interesting how it's concentrated in one very affluent neighborhood in the area. A lot of people I know have contracted alpha-gal, where they can't eat meat anymore.
Huh.
And anything produced by a cow, so cheese, milk products, ice cream included.
Well, that's pretty dangerous. You can't even eat ice cream.
I know.
Yeah,
it's summer.
What are you going to do all summer, huh? Well, listen,
bad.
You know, you spoke earlier about what went on there at Plum Island. And the interesting thing is that all began back in 1956, right after World War II. All of this germ warfare kind of thing began then. And there's a fellow by the name of Dr. Mitchell gave the dedication of Plum Island there by reminiscing on the late World War. And he said if we had had what we were going to be doing here with germ warfare going on at the time of World War II, we could have very quickly won the war. Well, when he was giving that speech, there was a fellow by the name of Dr. Eric Traub who was in there, and he was the director of the new virus laboratory in West Germany. And he had been invited by Plum Island director Morris Shahan to be there at the opening ceremony of Plum Island. And when he heard what was being said, it says he sat there perspiring and staring because, strangely enough, he had every right to be there because he was one of Plum Island's founding fathers, right out of Germany. So when we begin to trace these things and we find out that the United States government prohibited people from going in, they prohibited any news media from going into Plum Island until 1992. And yet, Richard Nixon cut off the so-called germ warfare plan by 1969. In other words, that place continued to be exceedingly dangerous from 1969 to 1992 for certain. This is a big deal. Mm-hmm. And we'll talk more about that when we get back and see what happened to Catherine Campbell's daughter, a precious young lady. We'll be right back.
Have you ever considered what the early church was like? Many people are developing a heart longing for greater fulfillment in our practices as Christians. A recent study showed 53,000 people a week are leaving the back door of America's churches in frustration. What is going on? Why has there not been even a 1% gain among followers of Christ in the last 25 years? Could it be that God is seeking to restore first century Christianity for the 21st century? Jesus said, "I'll build my church." Is Christ by his Spirit stirring to prepare the church for the 21st century? The early church prayed together and broke bread from house to house. They were family, and it was said by all who observed, "Behold how they love one another." Incredible.
But the same can be found right now. Go to saveus.org and click Sell Church. We can revive first century Christianity for the 21st century.
It's about people, not programs. It's about a body, not a building.
That's saveus.org. Click Sell Church.
Research on biological weapons seized when the United States Biological Warfare Program was ended in 1969 by Richard Nixon. At least we're told that's when it ended. The original anti-animal biological weapons mission was to establish and pursue a program of research and development of certain animal or anti-animal biowarfare agents. By August of 1954, animals occupied holding areas of Plum Island, and research was ongoing within Building 257. It continued work on biological warfare research until the U.S. program was ended by President Richard Nixon in 1969. The bioweapons research at Building 257 and Fort Terry was shrouded in aura of mystery and secrecy. The existence of biological warfare experiments on Plum Island during the Cold War era was denied for decades by our United States government. But in 1993, the year we started Save America Ministries, Newsday unearthed documents proving otherwise. So that's the distillation of the story of Plum Island. If you want to find out more about that, you can see if you can find the book called Lab 257, The Disturbing Story of the Government's Secret Plum Island Germ Laboratory. But aside from that, we're here now to talk with Catherine Camp concerning the reality of how she and her family dealt with the mystery of Lyme disease that seemed that baffled medical practitioners. The doctors knew nothing about it, didn't know how to diagnose, and so her daughter suffered and suffered and suffered from the fifth grade all the way up to at least 18, 19 years of age. Then what happened, Catherine?
Well, once we found out from the biologist what was in her blood, we saw it, we knew where to look. So we watched the documentary, and I took copious notes on every doctor in that documentary,
mm-hmm.
and looked them up, found where they practiced, and, you know, as God would have it, he led us to the one in D.C. But let me tell you, with him, he was chased out of North Carolina because he was treating and curing people, and the treatments were very harsh, like cancer patients, because you cannot kill these things in your body once they've manifested and been there for a long time. Well, he got chased out the same way the doctors who were standing up during the COVID era and speaking up, they treated him that way years before. He knew what was going on when COVID hit. And they silenced them, and they silenced him. Kicked him out of North Carolina. So, as God would have it, he ended up in Washington, D.C. But just to clear everything up about him, a decade later, the North Carolina Medical Association had to call him and apologize, and he insisted that they have a written apology for kicking him out.
Wow.
But anyway, yeah. So, and I was there when he got the phone call. I just happened to be there because my daughter had an appointment that day.
Mm-hmm.
But we just ended up going there, and she was in the top 5% sickest patients that they had. They had to put a port in her the heart valve area.
Wow. A port in the heart.
Where all the medications would be put. I had to go through lessons. I had to sign a contract that I wouldn't give up because it becomes very, very, very difficult. And a lot of people give up.
Mm-hmm.
People who are married end up getting divorced because, this is also, like you mentioned, it does cause encephalitis. Lyme encephalitis causes the brain to swell.
Mm-hmm.
A person is very uncomfortable, and they don't even know what they're doing half the time, although you think they know because they're functioning.
Yeah. Well, I know your husband, and he's a fine fella. Did this put pressure on your marriage?
No, not at all. Once we found out what was going on, it was wonderful that, we were like a team.
Great.
our daughter couldn't handle being in her own atmosphere at home because it brought back too many memories of, hey, you know, all of her childhood friends were matriculating through college.
Right.
And she was held back because of this disease.
Oh.
And she could barely get her head off of the pillow many days. And we would just pray for blue sky seconds. You know, those were my prayers. Like, the doctor told us, eventually she'll start to have blue sky days, but it'll start with moments. So he wanted me to document when she was lucid, because she could barely get out of bed. She couldn't get off the sofa. Anyhow, there's a lot of details, but I won't, you know, go through all of that.
Well, sure. We but only have happened. A few minutes, so.
That's right. That's right. So she had to take a lot of very serious antibiotics, liquid form, and then many supplements. In fact, it took 6 months of supplements to get her body up to par in order to handle the heavy-duty antibiotics that she was going to have to take through, like a cancer patient.
And she didn't have to take chemo, though?
No.
No, chemo, just heavy antibiotics, okay.
Heavy. There's one drug that was really the worst. It was Tigacil.
Mm.
And that goes right into your bone marrow because he had to kill all the any bacterium and organisms that were lodging themselves in her bone structure.
Unbelievable.
So, yeah, and so that would make her the sickest. I mean, literally the first drop because I had to learn how to deal with IV bags and putting the medications in there and all that. So that was rough for her, but it took 9 months for her to finally start coming out of those drugs, to finally start being able to, okay, well.
And how long did that take? How long did it take for her to seemingly begin to observably come out of that terribly debilitating condition?
About 9 months.
Okay. Under the heavy doses of antibiotics.
Yeah. Yes, okay. Heavy doses.
All right.
We couldn't even go walk outside because she would get tired just going in the driveway, you know.
So her immune system was destroyed essentially by Lyme disease.
Yes. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And so, yes, it took 9 months, and then it's taken most patients who get treated properly by the right kind of doctors, and it has to have a Lyme-literate doctor.
Uh-huh.
So anyone out there struggling, you have to go to a Lyme-literate doctor.
How do you find such a doctor?
For anything less. You start to look it up. I would go to LymeDisease.org. They have a list of really good doctors. And another one is Global Lyme Alliance.
Global Lyme Alliance, okay.
Alliance.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And so those two, they have like a newsletter, which really is helpful because they tell you about new things coming down the pike, new treatments for people, and they talk about doctors. And that's how I found some of the doctors that I tried to get her in to see, like a Lyme arthritis doctor. They wouldn't take her because they had so many patients. That's the problem. There are few doctors because they cannot be on the insurance grid. That's another problem.
In other words, the insurance will not cover their treatment.
No.
Wow.
That's why most people die. It's either ignorance because they don't know what they have, or they can't afford it. They just can't afford it. It takes about 6 years after you start getting treated for people to start coming into their own again as a human and start realizing, okay, I can do this. I can be active again. I can have a job again. I can drive again. Our daughter did not drive for almost 2 years because she didn't know where she was. And she got scared. She would get too tired.
How old is she now?
26.
So from fifth grade, age 10, up to 26, 16 years When was it, how old was she when it seemed like she was, say, 90% recovered?
About 2 years ago. So about 2.5 to 3 years into the treatment, she had the port removed from her chest. Actually, it was 3 years. And she just went cold turkey and stopped taking all of the prescription drugs, because at one point she was on over 15 prescription drugs, including high doses of gabapentin.
Oh, my.
And things, things that people only take when they're much older, and many others. And then the rest were supplements. So she had 64 pills a day that she had to take. 64.
Oh, my.
And she just stopped cold turkey and said, I've had enough. And that the port was removed, and she started even getting better. I would say, I think a lot of the prescription drugs were keeping her feeling sick all the time.
Uh-huh. I can well understand that.
Getting better. Uh-huh. Yeah.
So what is she doing now?
Well, she's a rodeo photographer.
And takes the most fantastic pictures, doesn't she?
Yeah, she does. She does really well at that and takes photographs of horse shows now. And she just, she's living more of a normal life of a 26-year-old now.
Uh-huh.
So.
Wow. Well, I remember a number of years ago when you had invited my wife and I to your home together with a number of other people for a dinner. And I remember your daughter came in there, and she was suffering at that time. And you were extremely concerned. And, of course, you and I have had a lot of interaction since then. I've been on your podcast a number of times, and we just have great Christian fellowship together. But this has been one of the most horrendous challenges a parent could ever have to undergo, isn't it?
It is, and especially if you don't ever find out what's going on. So that's my big warning to people, is if you can't figure out, if the doctors can't figure out what's happening, I would strongly suggest either go to your vet, make friends with your vet and have them look at a little prick of blood.
Yeah. Well, I understand that there is a vaccine for pets concerning Lyme disease, but not for humans.
Whether it's actually helping, I don't know. But,
yeah, right.
I really don't know, and I have my own opinions now after the debacle of 2021
exactly.
That we've just been through. I would be very careful with that.
But, All right. So we're right at the end of the story here, and we see that there was hope at the end of the journey, but it was darkness for a very, very long period of time. The Bible, Jesus said, he that endures to the end shall be saved. To put a little bit of a natural spin on that, you had to endure, your daughter, you and your husband, your family had to endure a great deal to persevere to the end on this. So I appreciate so much, Catherine, your coming on. I know that this is a passion of yours, and rightly so. I trust that it's encouraging and perhaps warning also to a lot of people out there. Don't take this casually. I certainly don't take it casually. And I thank so much you're coming on. Friends, we're confronting the deepest issues of America's heart and home from God's eternal perspective. We're Christians here. We're talking about this. This is a serious situation, almost like sin in our lives. Become a partner, friends. Send your gifts by faith to Save America Ministries, P.O. Box 70879, Richmond, Virginia 23255. Call us, 1-800-SAVE-USA. And if you like further counsel concerning this, please give us a contact, give us a call, and we'll make it available.
You've been listening to Viewpoint with Chuck Chrismeyer. Viewpoint is supported by the faithful gifts of our listeners. Let me urge you to become a partner with Chuck as a voice to the church declaring vision for the nation. Join us again next time on Viewpoint as we confront the issues of America's heart and home.